Next up on This Week in Law, Jorge Roig and Nina Paley join me and Sarah. We're going to discuss Google Books, the new DMCA exemptions, and scary tech policy, all next here on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Sarah Pearson. Episode 325, recorded October 30th, 2015. You got Kafka in my Orwell. This episode is brought to you by Braintree. Looking to set up payments for your business? Braintree gives your app or website a payment solution that accepts just about every payment method with one simple integration. Plus, Braintree will give you the first $50,000 in transactions fee-free. To learn more, visit braintreepayments.com/twill. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you all of the ingredients to cook fresh, delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell. Thank you for joining us for This Week in Law, our special day before Halloween edition in 2015. We are thrilled to be here. During the last couple of weeks, we've experienced our 9th anniversary of the show. That would have been last week when I was out of town on October 22nd. So yay, happy 9 years to This Week in Law. Thank you for joining us all that time, if you have, or for joining us just now, if it's your first time. Here's where we talk about all the really interesting, fascinating, cutting-edge legal issues that are created at the intersection of technology and law. And we get really amazing, wonderful, knowledgeable people to come on each week and discuss these issues with us. And this week is no exception. First, let me welcome back from South Korea our co-host here at This Week in Law, Sarah Pearson. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Denise. I'm so happy to be back.
Wonderful to have you back. It sounds like you had a wonderful trip.
We did. Yeah, it was a week in South Korea and a week in Japan. So it was my first time in Asia and it was awesome.
Wonderful. Really, and you were there for the Creative Commons World Global Summit, which sounds like it was a fabulous event. Want to pick your brain about that a little more maybe toward the end of the show. So remind me to do it if we don't get there in the ordinary course of business, okay?
Okay, absolutely.
All right, good. Also joining us this week, returning to the show, is Nina Paley. Hello, Nina.
Hello.
Wonderful to have you back. For those not familiar with Nina, she is a cartoonist, has been a cartoonist since she was a very young person. She's a filmmaker, a quilter, a singer. What am I leaving out, Nina?
Singer?
I think you sang on one of the last episodes that you were on with us. So I think of you as a singer. You're quite talented. Maybe not professional. So it's wonderful to have you back on again, Nina.
Thanks.
And joining us for the first time is Jorge Roig. Jorge is a law professor at Charleston School of Law, where he teaches constitutional law, IP and technology law. Welcome to the show, Jorge.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Hello, Denise. Hello, Sarah. Hello, Nina.
Hello.
Wonderful to have you. There have been all kinds of good things going on the copyright front. Well, good or interesting things. We can question whether some of them were good or not. But let's start out talking about copyright issues. So the show is 9 years old. That is 1 year younger than the Google Books litigation, which was originally filed in 2005 and has just been decided again. Several courts have issued decisions in this case along the way. The Second Circuit has now issued its ruling in the Authors Guild case. All of these rulings have been in favor of Google and fair use, and this one is no exception. What the upshot of this is that the book scanning project that Google has been engaged in all this time with various universities and libraries to scan digitally scan in their collections and make them searchable. When you search for such scanned material, you do not get the entirety of War and Peace or whatever it is you're looking for. You get a small snippet of text around what you were searching for, so it can give you context. You also get the ability to buy that work or access it in other ways if it is freely accessible. So it's an incredibly useful tool. And what the Second Circuit has done, along with other courts along the way, is decided that none of the use involved here is copyright infringement. A very big victory for fair use in this case. The Authors Guild is saying that it may attempt to appeal this case to the Supreme Court, but people who have been following the case closely don't think, well, they of course can buy into the fact that the Authors Guild will ask the Supreme Court to look at the case, but people don't seem to think that the Supreme Court will bite on that and actually take the case under review. And if it does, folks think that it will probably be affirmed as it stands now. So, Jorge, you are one of the people, I'm sure, who's been following this case closely. Tell us what you think now, 10 years down the road into the Google Books litigation.
Well, I will say something that you don't hear law professors say very often, and that's that I think the court got it completely right in this case.
Mm-hmm.
I think the opinion is well written, it's well researched, it's well justified. And it's a happy opinion for me. I think it's a very good one.
Describe for us, if you will, its impact. Now that we know that what Google has been doing all along is fair use, do you think Google will be the only party digitizing the scholarly and literary works of the world, or will this now become a more widespread phenomenon?
Well, I think it should help to dispel a little bit of the uncertainty. The Second Circuit is, of course, an important circuit that includes New York, among other important states, and so it's a very strong pronouncement from a very well respected court, and the impact in this particular case, I think, is very big because of the huge project that Google is undertaking along with some of the most important libraries in the country and in the world. In a bigger picture even than that, I think the way that the court analyzes fair use is very good for free speech particularly and for the sharing of art. They take a broad approach to what uses are fair, at the same time taking a more restrictive approach to the definition of what a derivative work that is protected on the copyright would be. And so I think it's good for the sharing of information in general.
Can you give us some examples, Jorge, of the way the court has narrowed what a derivative work would be, for example?
Well, there's some interesting language there, and I think this will be deconstructed by people like me and other courts. But there's some interesting language about the idea that a derivative work transforms the original work in ways that do not change its substance. So they refer back to the statutory examples of translations, adaptations into plays or movies, and they seem to not talk about other types of transformations that are more substantive. So, for example, an example that came to my head immediately was sequels, right? Some people have thought of sequels as derivative works of the original, and the language that the court uses in this case doesn't seem to include sequels. I don't know, I don't know if we can take them at their word completely for it, but I thought it was interesting that they didn't mention that example for one.
Well, playing that out, if I wanted to write another tome in the Harry Potter saga, obviously I would have copyright issues even after this decision, wouldn't I?
Yes. I mean, there are other issues with sequels, particularly in terms of the characters themselves. So courts have held in the past that characters can be copyrighted. And so the use of the Harry Potter character might be a direct infringement of the copyright over that character per se. So it limits the scope of potential derivative works, but it still conserves the scope of the original copyright over a character, for example.
Nina, fair use is near and dear to your heart. It came up in connection with your wonderful animated film, Sita Sings the Blues. I'm guessing you're happy to hear that this decision has come down from one of the most important federal appellate courts in our country.
Yes, and it has some good, it makes me a little bit more hopeful about my current film in progress, which relies entirely on fair use to be shown in public. The only venues that are going to show it are going to be venues that assert fair use.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about that project.
Well, Sadomasochism is sort of like Sita Sings the Blues, but based on the Passover story, based on the Book of Exodus. And I'm not asking permission to use anything, so I'm just using anything that I want for the sake of the art. And when it comes time to release a official legal version, I will redact all of the music and replace it, or at least the contentious music, and replace it with director's commentary, thereby releasing an inferior legal product and hopefully highlighting what the law requires in terms of, I would say, compromises or maybe even destruction of art in order to conform to the law.
Yeah, so in a sense, your art has a couple of levels there, the original work itself and also your commentary on what the work would be if you were not constrained by copyright law.
Yeah, I mean, the work is still going to be awesome. It's just not going to be legal. So we'll have the illegal work and then the legal work, and people can decide for themselves which is better.
Wow, we're looking forward to that, and we're seeing some of the great animation. You've been having fun with GIFs on Facebook of bits of your work in process, which are always fun to see.
This is Sita Sings the Blues here.
Right.
So Sadomasochism is new.
Yes, and if folks are following you on Facebook, they can get little teases of it. We have Sarah co-hosting the show here, who is senior counsel for Creative Commons, and Creative Commons creates an avenue to perhaps add things to works such as the one that you're involved in right now. Nina, did it cross your mind to try and use music and other materials that are licensed for the kind of use that you'd like in your film?
Well, several years ago, this was recommended to me at a conference to basically only try to limit my exposure to culture exclusively to that which has free licenses. And I tried doing that for maybe a day. And then I just wept because I was like, there's this whole world of culture. And it's just not right to try. I mean, it's impossible to try to filter works based on law, especially when I go out and, you know, hear music playing in public that's proprietary. You just can't, you know, our brains don't have these legal filters. Oh, sorry about a siren. Maybe you should mute me and talk to somebody else for a minute.
That's okay. It sounds like it's
they're coming for
well
you.
On its way. Yeah, exactly. Released the non-compliant.
Yeah, anyway, just the idea of selecting cultural works based on their license is the most inverted and backwards and kind of sick approach to culture that I could think of. I mean, the whole thing about art is it really, art itself is not concerned with licenses. So my whole approach, which I think everybody's approach is, whether they realize it or not, I mean, where your heart is, your heart really doesn't care what the license is. And, I need to fall in love with music And I do fall in love with music, and I just do. I just let myself do that.
Right. Well, Sarah, I hope this isn't too discouraging for the future of Creative Commons.
No, not at all.
Yes.
I completely understand the sentiment. As a lawyer, I guess my legal filters are, you know, built in a little bit more, but I completely understand that restricting yourself to any type of content, you know, whether it's CC licensed or not, is an artistic, you know, a barrier. So I completely understand where you're coming from there. And I root for you, even though as a lawyer, I wouldn't be able to, advise you to do that. But I think it's
land beyond lawyers at this point.
Yeah,
but I respect that. But I use Creative Commons licenses for my own work.
Yes. Yeah, you're one of our stars that we talk about a lot. And I'm right. You used to use a share-alike license for CETA and then switched it to the public domain. Is that right?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. And in the future, it's like, I think when I put up the clips on Vimeo, I think I use ShareAlike by default. I now think of ShareAlike as like my controlling license. So if I want a little bit of control, that's what I use, or the illusion of control. And then when I'm ready to let it all go, then CC0.
Yeah, that makes sense. When I was at Stanford's Fair Use Project, we used to advise documentary filmmakers on fair use of clips and music and things. And oftentimes, if something was questionable, that's when we would say, you know, have you considered looking for CC licensed substitute? But I was going to ask you, Nina, in this new film, are you going to also strip out stuff that's kind of more obviously a fair use? Are you going to take out just anything that's proprietary? Or are you going to take out things that are kind of questionably fair use? Or
yeah, well, actually, that's an interesting question. Because like with This Land Is Mine, which is the final scene in the movie and the first one that I did, that is like so obviously fair use. And I haven't had a single takedown on any of the channels that it's been on. So that one definitely go in, but it's interesting. Like, it would be great if in 2 years, people acknowledged all of my use of music as fair use and the movie could simply be legal. I mean, it is fair use. It's just, I don't think anybody has really set a precedent for something like this. And of course, I would love to set that precedent, but that's going to require courage on the part of venues.
Right.
Yeah, it is. You know, what most people do when they're in your situation, Nina, is err on the side of being cautious, that if it could be considered infringement, maybe we should use something else, or maybe we should use less of it. But when you consider, you know, God knows none of us who have law degrees on this show today are going to be able to sit here today and tell you, oh, yeah, that use that you have in mind is definitely fair use, because that's really hard to predict on the front end. You really need to get it in front of a court and see what the court does with it and how it applies the factors. But that said, using bits, snippets of music, not making the music available in a way that prevents or interferes with the commercial exploitation of the music, it is the kind of thing that often is found to be fair use. So it sounds like you're going to take the opposite approach here and say, I don't know if it's fair use, but I think it is, and put that to the test.
Yeah, and also I'm not using snippets of music. I'm using whole pieces of music. But I didn't the Google Books decision, wasn't it written in the decision that actually a work in its entirety can be used and still in a transformative way? Am I wrong about that?
Jorge, does that sound to you?
You are right about that, yeah, because one of the things that Google does is it makes a digital copy of the whole book, of course. And so the court says, as long as you're using that for the transformative purpose of allowing people to do these searches in the book, then you're fine. That's a fair use. So the question is whether the transformative use that you are putting it to is sufficiently transformative in the same way that the Google use is sufficiently transformative.
Right. Yeah, and of course it's a totally different way to use it, right? But what is odd is that the uses in my films would only increase sales of the music. I don't even get how somebody would think that that would reduce the commercial viability of the music. But I guess they do.
That is an interesting issue that I think comes up a lot in these fair use debates. And of course, it goes back to the Sony v. Universal case in which some movie studios were trying to outlaw video VHS tapes and the VHS technology in general, or the Betamax in that case, but the equivalent. And some of the movie studios said, listen, this could be a potential source of revenue in the future. We're not going to oppose this. And that's what ended up happening, right? The video rental industry became a huge new revenue source for the movie studios. And so I think it's a business decision that sometimes copyright owners make with a very myopic eye towards the future. I agree with you. A lot of these fair uses, all they do is stimulate the market for the original instead of constraining it.
Yeah. By the way, my distribution plan is not to get a distributor, but to get a legal team to help defend venues or reassure venues that they can screen it under the doctrine of fair use.
Yeah, that sounds smart. We'll go ahead and make myopia our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We are talking about issues that relate to, you know, this new decision out of the Second Circuit, all sorts of tech law and policy issues throughout the show. So if you're a lawyer or another professional required to have continuing education credit as part of your profession, this might be one way that you would be interested in getting it. So if you're a lawyer and you need more information about that, go to our wiki at wiki.twit.tv. We have a list of the various U.S. jurisdictions with help for how you might apply to get credit for watching This Week in Law to help satisfy your continuing legal education requirements. And we put these phrases in case you have to demonstrate to your oversight board that you actually watched or listened. So we'll put one more in a little bit later in the show. What we're going to get to in a moment is the DMCA rulemaking that just came out from the U.S. Copyright Office, which carves out some exceptions to the anti-circumvention provisions of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Before we do that, though, we're going to thank our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is Braintree. Braintree is code for easy mobile payments. Maybe you're working on the next Uber, Airbnb, or GitHub. Then why not use the same simple payments solution that helped them become what they are today? Braintree makes mobile payments so fast, easy, and seamless, it's almost magical. Add it to your app with just a few lines of code, and you're instantly ready to accept Apple Pay, Android Pay, PayPal, Venmo, credit cards, even Bitcoin. And if some other way to pay comes along, Braintree will support that too. Braintree's fast payouts and continuous support mean you'll always be ready, whether you're earning your first dollar or your billionth. See fewer abandoned carts and more sales with Braintree's best-in-class mobile checkout experience. Braintree gives you a full-stack payment solution, support for all payment types your customers might want, single integration across all platforms with superior fraud protection, customer service, and fast payouts. Check it out for yourself. Go to braintreepayments.com/twill. Thank you so much, Braintree, for making it easy for folks to get paid and for your support of This Week in Law. All right, let's talk about these new DMCA exemptions. What happens, folks, if you haven't been playing along with this saga with the Copyright Office for years and years now? This is, gosh, I wonder how many rulemakings we've had since the enactment of the DMCA. It's quite a few now. It happens every 3 years. And what happens is folks petition to the Librarian of Congress and say, okay, there are various uses, various reasons why you would need to circumvent copy protections that do not amount to copyright infringement and should be carved out of violating the DMCA. And even though the Copyright Office may have decided, yes, an exemption is in order for that thing that you would like, every 3 years it comes up for review again. So we've just had that period take place, and the Librarian of Congress has spoken, and we have some new exemptions in place for things like jailbreaking devices. New this year, you can not only jailbreak or unlock your phone, but also a tablet now. You have limited access to mess about with the software in your car. You have limited means to mess with your 3D printer and perhaps make it use a different kind of printing material than the one the manufacturer would like you to use. Various other exemptions that have just come out. So, Sarah, let's go to you first. What do you think of this newest round of exemptions that we've been presented with?
I mean, so I read the few pieces in the rundown, and in some ways it's encouraging, and in some ways it's kind of depressing. The things that they're covering with these exemptions certainly makes sense, and there have been, especially the one about car software that also I think applies to even medical devices and voting machines and agricultural vehicles. That one's been in the news a lot after the Volkswagen debacle, and then there was also a John Deere story I remember maybe 6 months ago. When I guess it was probably when they were originally lobbying for this exemption, and John Deere came out saying, no, 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 this is, you know, a security issue. We can't have people tinkering with the software. So, I mean, it's in that respect, these really seem like a win. But just overall, from a kind of a meta scale, the fact that we even have to argue every 3 years to do things that people are lawfully entitled to do under copyright law, you know, this is, it's just kind of crazy to me that even if something is clearly falls within fair use, you still might not be able to do it, and probably can't under the DMCA because of these other statutory provisions, unless you have one of these exemptions. And that just to me just seems like a kind of perverse system, and I don't really understand what the argument even is to justify it. Because if something isn't a violation of copyright law, it shouldn't be. You know, it basically shouldn't be prohibited by the DMCA, but that's not where we are. So to me, I guess I'm kind of torn about, they seem like good wins from, you know, EFF side, but it's also just kind of depressing that we even have to have these fights every 3 years. So
it is. Catherine Trend Acosta wrote about this for Gizmodo. And she sums it up as follows. She says, these rules are so divorced from the reality of technology and how people interact with it. You have to wonder if the Library of Congress even knows what a computer is. More likely, instead of dismissing the arguments of large companies in favor of the letter of the law, these exemptions are designed to split the difference, with the end result being that they're barely usable by the people who need them. So better than nothing, but certainly not ideal. Do you agree with that assessment, Jorge?
Yeah, I completely agree with everything Sarah said and with the article in Gizmodo. The idea that it's divorced from the reality, not just of what technology is, but of how people are interacting with that technology, I think is very true and very powerful. And what ends up happening, I think, I don't have empirical data in front of me, but I feel pretty confident that young people just say, listen, if I can't comply with a reasonable law, I'm just going to go ahead and do things anyway. And so you are unknowingly maybe or naively thinking that this is not happening, but what is happening is you're discouraging people from following the law because you're making laws that are just unreasonable. And I think that's very destructive for our society and for our democracy.
Yes, as the mother of a youngster who likes to mess around with computers, I couldn't agree with you more. Nina, there's some good news for filmmakers in the latest round of exemptions. An exemption for the first time, this one was argued for by the EFF, and they got it, for accessing video. There are so many caveats, and you need to tread carefully to fall within the exemption. It's a good thing that you're already planning on legal teams to help your theaters, because, of course, as you're making your films, you probably need to have them at your right hand as well. But you do have a bit more latitude now to go ahead and break digital locks on video and include them in other works as long as you comply with all the requirements of this exemption. Are you encouraged by this at all, or do you still think that this doesn't go far enough
remotely.
An artist like yourself?
It's just ridiculous. It's like they could pass a law to criminalize breathing, and then 3 years later, it's like, oh, okay, you can breathe now. It's like, well, yeah, breathing the whole time. Thank you for telling me it's legal. When you were talking about that, I was thinking I have a friend who works deep in the copyright industries who did a app for a major media corporation. And this major media corporation locks down all of their movies and puts them in a vault. And they, paid him to make this app. And the only way he could get the material into the app that they were paying him for was to illegally, get the video, via his son, who knew how to do this. That's how they did it. That's how they made this very expensive commercial app for this company that could not, legally hand him their own material to put in the app. this is already happening, at the highest level of the copyright industries already.
Right. And this exemption for video is great if you're an educator, a critic, or a documentary filmmaker. But if what you're making is a more creative film, a fictional film, then you're not within the scope of this exemption. Jorge, I'm wondering if the Copyright Office, if you've followed this and know whether the Copyright Office has ever confronted the inconsistency between it's already, acknowledged as fair use. I guess the distinction is in the technology and not the law here, the one that I was going for, because the music industry has decided, they played around with putting digital locks on music CDs, decided not to. Of course, everything distributed digitally, a lot of it still, it does have DRM. But then the movie industry has always ensured that however its products are distributed, digital technologies protect it from copying and infringement. So, do you see an inconsistency here that, I guess, just because of the business decision these two industries have made, one type of art is more accessible, the music, than the DVDs. Is there anything that the Copyright Office should be doing about that from the exemption standpoint?
Yeah, I think it is a very big inconsistency. And, wouldn't it be great if we had a federal statute that tried to make all these things consistent? We could call it something like the Copyright Act, right? I tell my students when I teach copyright law and IP in general, and I tell my students, if you look at the Copyright Act, it looks like this patchwork of special interest legislation that is just a great example of what people are constantly criticizing about Congress. And it creates all these completely unjustified inconsistencies. I mean, we have a different treatment of sound recordings that are analog versus sound recordings that are transmitted digitally. Why on earth would we do that other than because there are political realities that have happened throughout the years. And this is another example. I mean, the idea that fair use applies to copyright, but it doesn't apply to these anti-circumvention provisions, and so you can get you can be liable for breaking the DRM when the use you're doing is perfectly legal under the Copyright Act is absolute nonsense, in my view, honestly.
Right, and maybe we should discuss the extent of the authority of the Librarian of Congress, because it does seem like the librarian here in issuing these exemptions has put some restrictions in place that go further than the fair use doctrine does. Is that permitted?
Well, you know, it's a tricky question because the Congress has prohibited certain practices through the anti-circumvention provisions that definitely impinge upon fair use in the Copyright Act. And so to the extent that the Library of Congress is trying to regulate that those extra prohibitions, well, they're entitled to because Congress has passed an act. So in that sense, it's bad policy from my point of view, but not necessarily illegal. Now, there is also some interesting language here because they're trying to deal with things that aren't really dealt with directly in the Copyright Act, like 3D printing and like the car software and those kinds of things, voting machines. And so they're treading ground that is a little bit unstable. And so I think there might be some issues there in which they're regulating more than Congress has regulated so far.
Right. I have a question I guess it's more of a clarification. If you violate the anti-circumvention provisions of the DMCA, you're not liable for copyright infringement, right? You're just liable for violating the DMCA. Those are two distinct things.
That's the way I understand it, yeah.
Okay. I figured that must be the case, but I just wanted to clarify, because if not, it would really be confusing that you could violate copyright law without actually violating copyright law. But
Right. And it probably makes sense, Jorge, to have you remind us what the different penalties are for, you know, if you're guilty of copyright infringement, you're subject to a lawsuit. You can be sued for statutory damages, which can be whoppingly enormous, up to $150,000 per violation. But there are some fairly stringent penalties for violating the DMCA as well, correct?
You know, I don't remember them by heart. I'd have to look them up, the DMCA provisions. I can add, however, to the copyright that there can be criminal violations to the copyright law. So copyright is extremely serious, and the amount of remedies that the plaintiffs are granted are pretty extensive and unusual in a sense.
Right. One of the things that Boing Boing points out in its coverage, I believe it was written up by Cory Doctorow, and that would be my assumption. He generally writes about these kinds of issues for them, is that although the exemptions provide you with various means of various legal means of doing things that you might want to do with your technology, they don't make it legal to put together technologies that will do it. So it's still illegal, even though it's legal to jailbreak your phone. You better be pretty competent with code yourself, because it's still illegal to have your own startup business be based on, I'm going to make those tools now that people can now use because this exemption has come out. No. You can't do that. So as Corey points out, you have to go sleuth these things out on the dark net. They're not legal to produce, even if it is legal for you to do the act that they accomplish, which seems a bit absurd. Nina, any final thoughts on this?
Well, I was just thinking about the scary stuff, and this all sounds rather dystopian.
It does.
Seems like a fine candidate for scary pre-Halloween acknowledgement.
It does. It does indeed. And it does seem we have a story about George Orwell's 1984 that might be a good thing to bring up at this point, because what happened here is, of course, George Orwell is no longer with us, but his estate is fairly aggressive in enforcing copyright law around his famous novel. And in one instance recently, Josh Hadley is like us. You know, he does an internet distributed radio show. He runs 1201 Beyond and has a show there that he does. And he also, like many folks who have a web presence, distributes products and things to help support what he's doing. And he had a t-shirt that he was selling at Cafe Press that had some graphics and the numbers 1984 with the text below that is already here. The Orwell estate took issue with this, saying that he used George Orwell quotes and that this t-shirt design would have to be taken down because it violated the estate's copyrights in the work. So there are a couple of interesting issues here from the copyright standpoint. I'm assuming they did use the DMCA to accomplish this takedown request. So whether or not we know that there is just some recently issued law about you better be awfully careful if you're going to use the DMCA to take things down and consider the fair use doctrine before you do, or you can be subject to some strict penalties. So there's that in play. And there's also in play whether the actual work here could be an infringement, simply using numbers or the titles of books, which are not copyrightable, seem to make this a problematic takedown request as well. Do you agree, Jorge?
Yes, I definitely agree. And to add a little Kafka to your Orwell, I was looking through my statutory supplement here, and the anti-circumvention provisions also provide for criminal penalties. So in response to your previous question, it's just as bad as copyright. But the Orwell context, you know, the irony is just amazing. And I think it's, you know, this borders on frivolous, if not completely crosses into the frivolous. I mean, copyright does not apply to the titles of books. Copyright does not apply to short phrases, and certainly not to a number. And so I think their case for copyright infringement is non-existent. There could potentially be an interesting discussion regarding trademark, but I doubt that they have a trademark over the number 1984 to begin with, even if you could potentially register that mark, which is still a big question. But copyright, I don't see how you could possibly make a copyright argument here.
All right, Sarah, any thoughts?
No, I completely agree. And it's just one of those, the fact that it's coming from, you know, the 1984 estate is just, you know, you couldn't write that. You couldn't make that up. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And it reminds me of the, I don't remember how many years ago, but remember when Amazon pulled 1984 from, or, you know, disappeared it off of people's Kindles. And it was just kind of interesting because, you know, because of the nature of the book itself. And so this is another one of those situations actually prompted, I guess, by the rights holders, though, in this case, not Amazon. But yeah, I mean, it just, to me, it's just kind of unbelievable and tone deaf. I would love to see some sort of repercussions for this kind of frivolous DMCA claim, but I don't know if we're there yet. It doesn't seem like that we've seen much success with those kinds of claims, but.
Right. Well, again, you have to be really on top of your legal rights and really devoted to enforcing them, you know, instead of just saying, okay, I'm going to take it down, not going to make a big deal out of it. Who has the time or the money? You have to really take a stand to have a wrongful DMCA notice under, impose penalties on the person who issued the takedown. So Nina, you, speaking of takedowns, you have been.
Oh wait, I want to say something about the Orwell thing. Two things.
Please.
One is that I believe I read somewhere that actually it was an overreach by Cafe Press that the Orwell estate had taken down something that actually had quoted 1984, and then Cafe Press just decided to apply that to anything with the numbers 1984.
Uh-huh.
I think I read that somewhere. So it might, something this stupid might not actually be directly from the estate. It might be Cafe Press.
Right. And but again, it just sort of illustrates, you know, we're going to err on the side of caution. Oh, we've had to take down that kind of thing before. So we're just going to do it from now on.
Right. But there is this whole other layer, right? The layer of, you know, the service providers or the platforms, where the platforms like up their censorship and don't even, you know, because they're so afraid of a possible DMCA takedown. So then it gets even worse for the actual user because they're not just interacting directly with the estate. They're interacting with the platform, and the platform can censor them before the copyright holder ever does.
Right.
Right.
So
that's one thing. But then I also wanted to talk about estates in general. And I don't know if like a free culture trust has been discussed on this podcast, but that's something that I and other artists really want, because I'm guessing Orwell probably wasn't thinking like, oh yeah, let me leave my, you know, literary works to whoever is controlling it right now. And if there were like a real free culture trust, then artists like me and artists far less radical than me could entrust their automatic copyrights that you can't get out of even if you want to, to some group that would actually ensure that it stays free and that the stupid stuff doesn't happen.
Right. So how do you envision that working? I'm sure there's more about this online. It sounds like something that you have not just come up with here as we talk, but it sounds like you would, as opposed to letting the rights to your creative works pass with your estate, you would donate them to this trust, and then they would either be, CC zero or otherwise in the public domain per your instructions, or the trust would make a pact not to enforce copyrights. How would that play out?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, because there's, you know, if it's public domain, maybe there's not as much for you to do, but Tom Lehrer got some of his stuff, Sony or someone took down his own stuff from YouTube or something. Mm-hmm. And he just does not want that to happen. So for more like a real copyleft license, if you're actually copylefting your work, you just don't want that. You don't want these fraudulent takedowns happening in your name. And you want to make sure that no estate is going to be, or no entity is going to be claiming legal ownership of something. To the point where they're censoring other people. So, a sort of strong copyleft free culture trust would act as like the Free Software Conservancy, I guess, and actually prohibit people from doing these outrageous takedowns.
Right. And it wasn't the case in the example that you're giving us here, Nina, he had already granted a license to Sony.
Oh, he had, but the thing is, he, like many artists, he just never really thought about it, you know, like this, I think, made him actually think about copyright a little bit. And he hasn't been completely radicalized, sadly, but, I'm pretty sure, you know, from what I understand, he really does not want Sony to do this again, or whoever, I don't know, whoever's claiming to have control over it.
Right. Time to renegotiate. Sarah, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to say that Creative Commons has been, not me personally, but people within Creative Commons have been in touch with the Free Culture Trust and involved in it, and kind of exploring different ideas. And one thing that has been talked about, but I don't think it's gone anywhere yet, at least, is this idea of springing licenses, so that either upon death or upon some sort of date in the future, a license would, either that's when a license would apply, or that's when a license would then become less restrictive, or maybe then go to the public domain. But as you can imagine, especially with the estate laws, they're just, it's really, really complicated.
Right.
As a legal matter, but it is something that CC has been looking into for several years now, I think, actually.
Right. When you said springing, I was just having post-traumatic flashbacks to studying for estates and trusts on the bar exam. Something there was springing. I don't remember what. It was awful, though.
There are a lot of artists who claim to copyright during their lives, but they do say that, yeah, well, when I'm dead, sure. I'll let go of it then. So that's a very good idea.
Right. Yeah. Nina, on the point, sorry, Jorge, was I interrupting you?
I wanted to say something about Nina's first point, so you can come back to me after we're done with the trust.
Go ahead, because I was going to shift gears into some other takedown shenanigans that Nina has been subject to lately.
Okay. I just wanted to mention, I mean, we live in a culture that is so obsessed with incentives, right? We're always thinking about how we establish the correct incentives so people will follow them and be good people. And it seems to me that in this area, we are setting the exactly incorrect incentives, right? And so you have, as Nina was saying, the incentive to err on the side of caution and take everything down. You have the incentive to file notice and take down provisions and filings. And we don't have an effective disincentive when people misuse those tools. And I think that happens in a lot of areas of the law, but certainly in the notice and takedown situation. This 1984 thing, I'm happy to hear that it wasn't the Orwell estate, but rather Cafe Press that was overzealous. But they should, get a slap in the hand at least for doing that. You know, there should be some consequence for their overzealousness. And the phrase chilling effect, I also teach constitutional law, so I'm into free speech. And chilling effect is a big deal in free speech jurisprudence. And we never hear that phrase or seldom hear that phrase in the copyright context. And I think that's what's going on, right? The internal censor that Nina talks about in her TED talk is very much present and shouldn't be.
Right. It would make sense to amend Section 512F of the DMCA to impose penalties not just on those who submit a takedown notice without good justification for it, but on companies who wrongly interpret copyright law in enforcing those notices. In other words, to impose some sort of burden on companies to actually get the law right. Now that I realize that jaded people listening to a lawyer say that might think, okay, so you're going to force companies to have good lawyers. Yes, I think that they should be forced to get the law right. Because otherwise, as we can see here, the guy with the radio show and the t-shirt trying to make a buck or two suffers.
We also need good judges, right? We need judges with a backbone that will put some teeth on the statutory provisions.
Right.
Because we have 512F, but nothing seems to happen.
Indeed. All right. Well, sort of along these lines, Nina, you have gone through a bit of a saga with Sita Sings the Blues in Germany and having it taken down under GEMA, correct? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. Well, I guess there's this ongoing dispute in Germany between GEMA and YouTube. And, my understanding of it is that GEMA's demanding like extra amounts of money from YouTube. YouTube is responding by just not showing any videos with music that GEMA has any claim to. And GEMA, of course, claims all music. So when Sita Sings the Blues, when people try to access it through YouTube in Germany, it's blocked. And that happened a couple years ago, or it happened, you know, after Sita came out, it was blocked in Germany. And people kept saying it's blocked in Germany. And I was like, there's nothing I can do. You know, what am I supposed to do? Like, find German lawyers. So finally, I made a video just, you know, trying to draw attention to the fact that this was happening and that I had licenses. Like, I held in my hands all these worldwide licenses to use the music in the film worldwide. And so why should it be taken down in Germany? But that's, it's not a DMCA takedown. It's YouTube not showing it because they're in a dispute with Gamma. I don't fully understand it. Anyway, after I posted that video, presumably somebody at YouTube flipped the switch and made it accessible. And then a few months ago, somebody said, oh, it's blocked in Germany again. And I guess it's blocked in Germany again. And, you know, other than showing this video over and over again, I mean, it's the same issue. I don't really want to make another video, but it's blocked in Germany. I hope that what's happening is people are just realizing that there's all kinds of video platforms other than YouTube. For example, you can get it from archive.org, but at the same time, YouTube is very prominent and big, and having something unavailable on YouTube is not good.
No, and it really does highlight how, you know, you can try and be as diligent as possible with even, you know, if you're not pushing the envelope, you can make sure that your work is compliant with laws in the U.S. And still you might find other countries have other organizations' laws and procedures in place that wind up treating it differently. Here, GEMA or GEMA is a performing and mechanical production reproduction rights organization in Germany. So it's basically an arm of the entertainment industry there and enforces rights on behalf of its members. It's voluntary, but apparently aggressive. Any more insights on this, Jorge?
Well, you know, this is sort of a segue to a question that I wanted to ask Nina, and it was about her TED Talk and the videos that you played during your TED Talk. And I was wondering if you had any pushback from the folks at TED when you showed that.
No, because TEDx they're independently organized. So a TEDx, I mean, it's the TED branding. I guess they're licensed. They have some licensing thing with TED. But this was up to the organizers of that particular TEDx Maastricht conference. And they're rather courageous. They invited me. So they knew what they were getting. And, you know, they're not cowardly.
Right. Where is that in the world, Nina? Maastricht.
The Netherlands. It's a beautiful city, actually.
Uh-huh. Cool. All right. Well, I think we should probably move off of copyright and discuss some other things before we go ahead and wrap up the show. One thing I'd like to discuss is some of your writings and speaking, Jorge, on DNA, always a fascinating topic. So we're going to talk about that under the rubric of free speech. Sure. See, Nina, this is what happens when our interns do our bumpers. We need a truly qualified animation specialist at some point. We may have to give you a call, although I'm so grateful for our interns who provide us with all kinds of support and the beautiful bumpers that we use. Let's talk about DNA. Sorry, go ahead.
They totally do the job. They work.
They do. Yeah. They do. All right. So, Jorge, you've talked in the past. Your TED Talk is about DNA and how it can be used as speech and also, you know, in ways that you might not have anticipated could ever happen. Kind of give us the lay of the land on this. Where do things stand?
Things stand in a very precarious position, or really they don't stand very much at all. there are a lot of concerns about the way people might use DNA in the future, both from a privacy standpoint and from a free speech standpoint. I think the free speech part of it is very much outside the radar of most people. A lot of people are concerned about the privacy issues, at least people that are sort of involved in DNA or involved in privacy. But the free speech part of it is something that came to my mind when I was watching the Colbert Report, of all things. He had a couple of geneticists on who had written a book about the DNA and the uses for it nowadays, and they encoded the book in a strand of DNA. And so that was sort of the pitch that they were making in that show. And it made me think, you know, DNA carries information, so it can be used as a medium for communicating information. And that's how I got started in down this path of researching DNA from a free speech angle.
Right. And just playing off what we were speaking about a moment ago, I wonder how folks are starting to look at DNA as an information storage system and how it might be subject to the DMCA. How are you going to put encryption measures on the DNA that you might be storing your book on or what have you? Has that ever come up?
No, not that I've seen, but that is a great point, right? Once you start storing things in DNA, you're going to have to start, or people are going to start making ways of encrypting it and keeping it from public use. And so, yeah, that's a great, you know, that's another article to write.
All right, good. We know that DNA can carry information. Information can be speech. What is the next logical thing we should be concerned about?
You know, part of it is, so we know DNA has information. So we are beginning to learn how to read it, right? And a lot of the work so far has been about learning that language, so to speak, that the DNA speaks in. But we have also learned recently how to write in that language. And so that is the part of the concern that I think is surfacing now. Mm-hmm. And the Myriad case that the Supreme Court saw a couple of years ago had to do with this idea of I have created or I have isolated a particular strand of DNA. Can I now claim it as mine? In the context of that case, under the patent law, and curiously enough, in that case, the ACLU raised an argument as an amicus in that case regarding free speech, but it wasn't dealt with by the court because they disposed of the case on statutory grounds.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's talk about DNA. From a speech standpoint and from a privacy standpoint, is the Fourth Amendment triggered? Putting your con law hat on here, and not just from a First Amendment, but Fourth Amendment standpoint when it comes to DNA?
Right. The court dealt with a case about that recently. And so far, the analogy that has been made has been to fingerprints, right? So mm-hmm. The idea is, When you are compelled to provide your fingerprints, the courts have long held that's not a Fourth Amendment or Fifth Amendment issue because it's something that is in plain sight, so to speak, and it's only used to identify you, right? And they have taken the same tack with respect to DNA, saying, listen, when we take your DNA and do something with it, it's just about identifying a person. The problem is DNA conveys a lot more information than just your identity, right? It says a lot of things about your propensity for certain diseases, about your appearance, about your ancestors, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot more information. I mean, actually, it says everything about your body, right? Mm-hmm. We just don't know how to read it yet, but it's all there, and it's just a matter of time till we learn how to read most of it. And every day we get new studies that show more and more information that you can get out of the DNA. One area in which there have been some studies is whether there are certain genes that are correlated with our ideological preferences. So there have been studies finding correlations between certain genes and the propensity to be conservative or to be liberal, which, if you think about it from a governmental perspective, it's very troubling to think that the government might have access to that information.
Right. So it really is going to have to fall under privacy law if it is something that should be protected from scrutiny. It is not a creative work in the way contemplated by copyright law. So I think it's safe to say that your DNA information isn't going to be subject to the same kinds of legal considerations as, for example, Nina's films. But you could see where people might want it to be, where they might want it protected from use and reuse and scrutiny in various ways. One of the one of my favorite episodes of the Big Bang Theory features Penny giving Sheldon a napkin for Christmas. The napkin was used in the Cheesecake Factory by Leonard Nimoy. And she thinks that Sheldon will just think it's kind of cool that he now has Leonard Nimoy's napkin. But what Sheldon immediately thinks is, you've just given me Leonard Nimoy's DNA. I can make my own Leonard Nimoy. So, I mean, some of the considerations that we've been talking about in the show before with respect to copyright law might come into play here as well. You could imagine the estate of Leonard Nimoy being upset that someone has the DNA and might attempt to do things with it. Or you could envision someone wanting some sort of free culture trust where their DNA could be donated and freely usable. Is any of that kind of thing on the horizon as far as you know, Jorge?
I wouldn't say it's in the horizon from the congressional point of view. I think they're well sort of behind that. But it's certainly something that professors and scholars are thinking about and looking at. And so, there are so many angles about this. There are property angles. There are personhood angles, right? You mentioned this sort of feeling that people have of the DNA is mine and it's a part of me and it's somehow not just a part of my property, but a part of who I am. And there's also, from the artistic perspective, something that I found and I've talked about in my articles is there are people who are using DNA to create works of art. And so, for example, there's an artist who has created a glow-in-the-dark bunny. So it's a rabbit, a living rabbit that glows in the dark. And he calls it a piece of art. And it's also his pet, but it's an artwork. And so the idea that you might copyright the DNA sequence of that bunny or the bunny itself is also stuff that we have to be thinking about.
Yeah. Okay. You just blew my mind. The glow in the dark bunny on any number of levels. Sarah, how's your brain doing on all this?
Oh yeah. I'm just like, God help us. If DNA starts to be the next, I mean, I think Denise, I think you're completely right that copyright is kind of an obvious, it's the tool that everybody turns to when they don't have any other way to stop, the information from being distributed. So it's probably inevitable that there will be some copyright claim made to someone's DNA. I think that that is, you know, terribly, you know, it's just not the right way to go. It even though you might, and you can imagine lots of situations where you'd be incredibly sympathetic. And I think there should be some other, you know, privacy-based claim that people should be able to make. But copyright is definitely not the right tool for it, because it's just not, it has nothing to do with the original purposes behind copyright law. We don't need an incentive to create our own DNA.
Right.
Think about this, Sarah, though. If you patent it, you don't have fair use. So it's sort of like, you know, picking and choosing from two bad options. Because if you give patent to DNA, then, well, it's only 20 years, but there's no fair use. If you copyright it, it's a longer term, but at least there's fair use to help you out.
That's true.
All right, true. Nina, you may have to break that tie. Pick your poison.
Well, isn't that, I don't know what the acronym du jour is for whatever the latest secret trade agreement that is horrible and we're all trying to stop. But isn't it supposedly in a leak, it's coming up with a new category of IP having to do with biotech?
TPP.
Aren't they like, TPP. Aren't they like working on a whole new... a branch of intellectual property that this would fall under?
Poopery.
That would be an interesting way to go about it in an international treaty. You may well be right. There, you know, all we're talking about are leaks and rumors at this point.
I mean, just what we need, right? Yeah. Like, is even more IP, but I believe they're trying to build that.
Trying to build an entirely new area, but I do know that they're trying to expand I don't even know what the words are for them, the terms, but the different categories of rights that cover pharmaceuticals, like biologics and things like that, that I know nothing about, but they're trying to expand those to, you know, basically spread them around the world and make everything more restrictive as usual.
That sounds right. You said sounds right. I'm not at all. I don't keep up with this stuff, the details of it enough. But yes, what Sarah said sounds right to me.
Yes, and we should know more about it soon once it is foisted upon us and actually made public for the first time. I think you've given us our second MCLE passphrase, Nina, and that would be intellectual pooperty.
For the show title, I think.
Exactly. I don't know. I've been hanging around with 11 and 12 year olds too frequently. I got an email subject line "poo service" recently, relating obviously to the pool and not the poo. But intellectual pooperty will be our second MCLE passphrase. For the show, we should thank our second sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, too. Terrible segue from talking about biologics and biologic materials to our lovely second sponsor. We hope we haven't spoiled your appetite at all, but we're going to talk about Blue Apron right now, which is just one of my favorite products to ever come into my life, because you do need to know how to cook. And one of the things I was thinking about Blue Apron is, you know, for someone like me, once upon a time, I spent a lot of time thinking about how to cook. I went to cooking classes. I read cookbooks. I came up with ideas, you know, of delightful things I was going to make at home. And then I had a child. And time became more precious. And just simply getting food on the table became the priority, and not so much about how the food was prepared. So all the attention I used to spend in learning how to cook and honing my technique and thinking about what would kale be good in other than a salad, you know, that kind of thing, all went by the wayside. And then Blue Apron came into my life. And once again, every time I make a Blue Apron meal, I am being reminded and taught in a very subtle and easy way how to cook, because what Blue Apron sends you is all the ingredients to make your delicious food, recipe cards, and gives you tips about techniques you might not have tried before. So it really starts to, you know, if you've never known your way around the kitchen or you've kind of lost your way around the kitchen, it puts you back on track. It definitely tells you how to get around the kitchen. It also has you eating healthier. It has you saving money instead of ordering expensive takeout to be delivered to your house or going out to eat yet again, because Blue Apron costs just $10 a meal or less. It delivers all the fresh ingredients you need to create those home-cooked meals and, crucially, the beautiful step-by-step, very clear instructions. Each meal can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. No overwhelming trips to the grocery store. No more sad takeout. No more waste in your refrigerator. That's always a big deal to me, is when I would go and buy ingredients for the ambitious meal I wanted to cook. You know, two heads of lettuce wound up going bad in the fridge and needing to be thrown away. Also, it pays attention to your dietary preferences, makes it a breeze to discover and prepare dishes like Jamaican jerk chicken and Maduros, or salmon pastrami on rye with red cabbage and green apple slaw right in your own kitchen. Cook with ingredients that you've never used before, such as watermelon radishes, farro, and purple potatoes. Recipes are between 570 calories per portion. Delicious and good for you. And it really helps with those cooking techniques. Right now, you can get your first two meals free just by going to blueapron.com/twit. Check out this week's menu and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. Thank you so much, Blue Apron, for helping keep me on track in the kitchen and for your support of This Week in Law. All right, let us shift gears a bit away from DNA and to the halls of Congress and elsewhere to talk about some legislation and policy. So the CISA bill passed the Senate this week with a resounding majority, 74-21. It now goes to committee to have a version that both the House and the Senate can agree upon. But folks such as the EFF are sad and disappointed. Don't think that any amount of committee tinkering will help this bill. The concerns about the bill are sort of similar to what we were discussing earlier in connection with the Copyright Office, maybe not getting the way people use technology. Here, the concern is more lawmakers not really getting how technologies work, and that the security measures in the bill, this is supposed to be an anti- cyber exploitation kind of bill. It's supposed to allow one of the concerns of the bill is that it allows companies to share information readily with the government, personal information about customers. So sort of taking the NSA's PRISM program leaked by Edward Snowden and bringing it to light in a less secretive way, actually codifying, hey, you know, here's when you can and should be sharing information with us about your customers, technology companies. So there's that aspect of it. It's supposed to be securing computers against data breaches, but according to security experts, it doesn't really grasp that landscape well enough and address how security flaws happen. So it's still wending its way into actual legislation, but that Senate development happened this week. Jorge, have you been paying attention to this?
Yes, I have. And, you know, here's the silver lining. At least now they're telling us that they're spying on us, right?
Yes, exactly.
So you know that's a bit of an advance, but the the provisions are troubling. You know, the authorization and immunization of private companies for monitoring their systems is very, very broad. And so that is a concern. And the idea that these companies will be immune is also quite concerning because, you know, all the normal checks that you usually have in terms of defamation law, tort law, et cetera, are now being taken away. And so you're giving a carte blanche to corporations to spy on their clients and on anybody who uses their systems.
Sarah, any thoughts on CISA?
I don't know much about it other than what I read for today's show, but it certainly seems troubling, and at least on its surface, it's hard to understand why sharing the consumer's data with the government would actually help prevent cyber attacks or really what the public benefit would be. And I thought EFF's point about how this, you know, the fatal flaw of this legislation is that it doesn't actually address the problems that really cause these data breaches, like encryption and things like that. That seemed to me that really resonated. But I don't know a lot of the details, but it certainly seems troubling.
Right. As I consider this and consider the lawmakers that are grappling with, you know, how do we enact effective cybersecurity legislation and how do we know enough about it is that I want politicians and lawmakers who are qualified in this area. So I was a little disappointed watching the Republican debate this week when Chris Christie jumped all over the moderators for asking questions about regulating fantasy sports as gambling. As his point seemed to be, why are we even talking about that? That's not an important issue. But of course we do this show every week, so I'm biased. I think all these issues are important. And I really would like lawmakers and politicians to be more knowledgeable about them. One area that also came out at the debate, just a little insight. You might have missed it if you weren't someone who was already familiar with the net neutrality debate. But Carly Fiorina tipped her hand, and I'm sure she's spoken and written about this in the past, but at the debate, she made a side comment about the FCC's net neutrality regulations without actually invoking the doctrine, and made it pretty clear that she thinks that the FCC overreached there. We may as well make this one of our resources of the week, and we can talk about it, too, if anyone wants to discuss further. But InfoWorld, Carolyn Craig over there, did a nice piece showing where all of the 2016 presidential election candidates stand on net neutrality. If you're curious about that at all, you can find it in our discussion points, which are now located at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw to find out how they all feel about net neutrality. The Democrats seem to be the only folks who think that the FCC recently enacted rules should remain in place as they are. Any thoughts on this, Nina?
Nope.
Nope. Okay. How about you, Jorge?
Net neutrality. I think the most recent, because this saga is almost as long as, actually, it might be longer than the Google Books case. I think the most recent net neutrality order from the FCC hopefully will be upheld. I think there's some language in one of the early opinions by the Supreme Court that seemed to show the path to the FCC that this was the path that they had to take if they wanted to regulate this, and they seem to have finally listened to the Supreme Court. I believe it was Justice Scalia, of all people, that set out this path of treating the internet as a common carrier under the common carrier rules. And so I'm very optimistic about that. I hope that those will stand up to the muster.
All right. Well, since we're giving out resources of the week, I will mention the rest of them. We alluded to the fact that both Nina and Jorge have given TED Talks, and I encourage you to check them both out. Nina's is all about copyright. And can you tell us a bit more about it? We know it took place in the Netherlands. Give us a bit of a preview of your talk, Nina.
A preview of my talk.
A summary.
Digest. It's similar to other talks I've given in the past, but I guess the new bit is, I usually show culture moving from person to person in a line. But really it moves in a network, and that's like a neural network. And we can think of ourselves as neurons in a great mind. And when our ability to receive and transmit information is shut down, that's like brain damage in the great mind.
There we go. So, yes. That's a great analogy. And Jorge's talk is further to the issue of DNA and speech. This was a couple of years ago now, Jorge, or just last year?
A couple of years ago, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So for more on DNA and speech, definitely check out Jorge's TED Talk. And then we have one more video as a resource of the week, and this came from the Creative Commons Global Summit, where they got a surprise visit from a presidential candidate, Lawrence Lessig, also one of the founders of Creative Commons. And he talks a bit about the founding of Creative Commons. It's actually, I was sad listening to Professor Lessig talk. He seemed so tired, so happy to be there in Korea and not for just a couple of days running for president. And also there are some very sad moments in the talk about Aaron Swartz. Were you there for this, Sarah?
I was, yeah. And I mean, everyone probably is surprised that he wasn't supposed to be there, but because he always is at the summits. He always has been to the few that this is my third. We have him every 2 years. Mm-hmm. And he's usually, you know, the big keynote speaker. But this year, because of the campaign and other things, it didn't look like he was going to be able to come. And everyone was really disappointed, especially our CC Korea team. So it ended up being a surprise that his schedule worked out. That I think he was only in Korea, in Seoul, for maybe, I don't know, 10 hours or something crazy. He flew in and straight back to the U.S. in the same day. Which is a lot of flying for it, but he did seem really excited to kind of be back with his people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I can imagine.
And it was,
if folks missed him, he was on one of the recent Bill Maher episodes as well, with Bernie Sanders on that same show at the top mm-hmm. of the show as well. But he came in at the end of the show and spent quite a while talking about the presidential race and Bill Maher talking about how ridiculous it was that he wasn't part of the Democratic debate, and some of the other people were. Have you been following his candidacy at all, Sarah?
Not super closely. I did read just in the past week or so that he's kind of expanding beyond just being because he had been kind of telling people that he was a single issue candidate and he was, mm-hmm. Just going to do this one thing and then quit. It sounds like he's kind of changed his strategy to be, more of a realistic, a candidate that's covering all different issues. So that was kind of an interesting turn for him. But no, I haven't been following too closely. Actually, I haven't been following the presidential campaign in general too closely, even though I'm in Iowa, where we see candidates all the time everywhere. But that's why I'm kind of like, I can't deal with it yet.
There's probably one outside your window right now.
Probably is, yeah.
That's the scary Halloween bit.
Yes.
Yes, exactly.
That's one of the things that came up when he was on Bill Maher is that he said, yep, that I was wrong. I'm not going to be the guy who resigns on the first day in office because people don't take you seriously when you say that that's what you're going to do. Any thoughts on law professors running for president, Jorge? Any plans in your future?
No. I'm thinking of the current president. Can I just say I am disappointed that a constitutional law professor has continued with some of the spying and NSA craziness that has been going on in the last couple of decades. So I would hope that Larry Lessig would do a much better job on a few areas, particularly that one. I have been following, particularly not that much his campaign per se, but his previous work on campaign finance. And it's an issue I've done some research on recently and put out an article. So I think he's doing great work. And I hope he continues to, and I would love to support him any way I can.
Yes, I think that's probably true of all of us. And definitely, here's our tip of the week. Professor Lessig and probably anyone with just a tad more technological savvy than, say, Ted Cruz would know to register their name as a domain name before they decided to run for president. So Ted Cruz did not do that. TedCruz.com is owned by someone else who is using it for satirical purposes during the campaign. And over at Daily Kos, someone pointed this out recently. It seems sort of inconceivable in this day and age that a candidate who's been on the debate stage now at least twice with the rest of the Republicans doesn't have his domain name locked up. But Ted Cruz does not, despite his rather feisty performance in this week's debate. And none of the moderators called him on this. So your tip of the week, should you perhaps want to run for president someday, lockupyourname.com, one way or the other. What were you going to say, Jorge?
Particularly after what happened to Rick Santorum on the internet. Right?
True, yeah.
Right, yes. All right, so because we're right on the eve of Halloween here, I thought I'd go around and have people tell us what their most terrifying, the scariest bit of tech policy that looms on the horizon. What keeps you up at night, Jorge, when you think about the kinds of issues that we've been talking about today?
Artificial intelligence. And it keeps me up at night for the exact opposite reason that it keeps most people up at night. I am concerned about the attitude that I have seen from very smart people towards the possibility of artificial intelligence being developed in the future. Everybody seems to be very, very scared of the prospect that a computer might one day wake up and talk back to us. And I see a tendency of that, frankly, I can only describe as xenophobia, right? We immediately feel attacked by the idea that there might be a living, thinking being out there that is not like us for some technical or formalistic distinction. And so that's something that concerns me, that smart people, you know, people like Stephen Hawking and I think it was the Tesla CEO, Elon Musk, are making these statements that, you know, it's going to be the end of the world if artificial intelligence comes around. Well, why would it be? Why wouldn't we think that, you know, a computer would also have good feelings towards other sentient beings? I'm doing some research on that currently. So coming.
Okay. I like it. Fear the fear.
Yeah.
Terrifying fear. What about you, Sarah?
I think for me, it's probably just the state of privacy in the digital age and how no one understands what all is being collected about them. And even the people that are collecting it maybe don't fully understand the implications and the potential risks at stake. And, you know, all of the rules are kind of buried in these terms of service that no one reads. And we're relying on a legal fiction for that consent, and nobody understands it anyway. To me, that sort of thing does sometimes keep me up at night. Luckily, not very often, but I think it's really scary. And I don't really know what the answer to the problem is, and maybe that's why it's so scary. I think there are a lot of things scary about copyright as well, but maybe it's because I understand them better. I understand what the risks are and kind of who the players are. Whereas with privacy, it just kind of seems like a quagmire because there are just so many people involved and so many, it just kind of infiltrates our daily lives in a way that seems like it's easy to feel kind of futile about it, about privacy in a way that I don't as much about copyright. So not yes, to be depressing, but
no, it is depressing. The privacy in terms of service quagmire. I think this is what you look like after you've tried to slog through a privacy policy or somebody's terms of service. So yeah, quite terrifying. Nina, how about you?
Well, I don't really stay up at night in fear about these things, but there's mm-hmm. a lot going on that's just very, very sad. I think mm-hmm. Sarah used the phrase futility. I am sad watching the internet that really sort of liberated my work and really gave me such a life as an artist. It's just turning into a big TV station or something. It's going back to the broadcast model. And it's just really sad to see the life sort of being squeezed out of this amazing thing. I mean, I realize there's going to be more and more users of it, but the freedom that we had just a few years ago is just getting squeezed out.
And do you attribute that more to laws that don't understand the internet or to more bigger, more influential business interests using it?
Well, those two go hand in hand, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Facebook, I've used Facebook for years. And when I started using it, I was like, oh, this is just going to go the way of MySpace. You know, I'll use this for a couple of years and then on to the next thing. And it's like, oh my God, it's still here. And, you know, I'm really active on it because that's where my community is. So I'm, you know, part of this thing that's sort of choking off the, what do you call it? It's a kind of environmental destruction, you know? We have like the virtual environment, mm-hmm. The walled gardens. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, a lot of the stuff that's happening is just, you know, legacy players with all this power and money. I don't even know exactly how it's happening. You know, like it's sort of like the concentration of wealth into fewer and fewer hands. You can look to blame individual people, but it's something that happens on such a broad level that like wealth and power just get concentrated. Yeah, I don't have like a simple answer to why it's happening. Yep. I just know that it was like a lot of fun and very exciting a few years ago, and everything that I cherish about it is kind of fading away.
Yes, that's terribly sad, Nina. I mean, you succinctly summed it up, and I'm going to make light of it by saying, yes, evil empires are definitely something to keep you up at night. But what you're saying should not be trivialized, and I agree with what your sentiment you're trying to get across here, and people need to take that into account when considering the kinds of issues that we talk about week in and week out on the show, and considering how they're going to organize their business. You know, are you going to be the evil empire that makes people sad to participate in it, but they have to reach their audience? Or are you going to rise above that? My scary eve of Halloween bogeyman is twofold, one of which we've talked about, well, actually both of which we've at least alluded to on the show today. And it's because I spend a lot of time with young, inquisitive smart people who like to tinker and like to explore and aren't spending their spare time boning up on what it is they are and are not supposed to do and what the penalties are if they should happen to stumble afoul of what the letter of the law is. So the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and its potential felony liability for accidentally tinkering in the wrong way. Also, the DMCA and its criminal penalties should you unlock a digital lock and not be subject to one of the exemptions that we spoke of today. And yet still not be engaged in copyright infringement or building a business upon it. So I'm frightened of the way that people can blunder into some pretty serious legal penalties that they, or if they're young people, their parents might have no idea even exist out there. So that's my terrifying notion for the week. Sorry to leave you with such chilling notes at the end of the show here, but it is Halloween. We have to frighten you a little bit. We hope you have a very safe and fun Halloween, and that you go out there, have a great time over your weekend. If you are joining us at, if you started joining us at 11 o'clock Pacific time, that means you've been joining us while we recorded the show live. 11 o'clock Pacific, 1800 UTC is when we do that every week. So come on in, join us for This Week in Law if you can. It's always fun to have a live audience, always great to interact with our folks in IRC. If you can't do it, don't worry. If you head on over to twit.tv/twill, our whole archive of shows is there. You can go back and find Nina's prior episodes. You can listen to her singing, which I promise won't terrify you as much as what we just discussed. And you can find all 9 years of our show there if you're so inclined and want to spend some time digging into our archives. They are there for you. What else should I tell you? We have these discussion points, all the great stories that we've aggregated to get people on topic for the show. Those are available at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. And you should reach out to us on various means of communications, walled gardens and otherwise. You can email us. Sarah is sarahp@twit.tv. I'm denise@twit.tv. You can find us on Facebook. We have a page for the show there, also on Google Plus and a Google Plus community for the show as well. You can find us on Twitter. Our Twitter handles have been flashed at you throughout the show if you've been watching the video. If not, I'm D Howell there. Sarah is S Hinch Pearson there. Sarah, any final thoughts?
No, it was a nice, scary show for Halloween.
It was, yes. It was a fun show. Chilled. Though. Yes, very fun. And thank you so much, Nina, for joining us again. We wish you great luck on your current project and all your projects.
Thank you. It was really fun.
And Jorge, great meeting you. Anything we should know about going on at Charleston School of Law or otherwise with you?
There are some good things happening at the Charleston School of Law, actually. We are in a transition period, and we have a new president who has committed to turning the school into a nonprofit and having it be here for many, many years to come. So we're actually in the middle of some very exciting news.
Wow, that's really cool. Yeah. Are there other law schools that you know of that are run as a nonprofit institution?
Yeah, most of them are. So, mm-hmm. So we were one of the exceptions that we were being run as a for-profit, but hopefully that'll change in the near future.
That's very cool. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been great getting your thoughts and insights on everything we've discussed today.
Thank you for having me, and it's been great to meet you all, and I hope we keep in touch.
Me as well. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. We'll see you next week on This Week in Law. Take care.
Thanks. Thank you.